Whether he's writing about science, language, or travel, Bill Bryson's books are both funny and smart. The best-selling author is a master at turning the seemingly isolated and mundane fact into something both meaningful and fascinating. He's well known for his humorous travel memoirs, and in his new book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life, Bill Bryson takes the notion of travel writing in a whole new direction, indoors. Realizing how little he knew about the 19th century parsonage he and his family live in, Bryson decided to travel through his own house, one room at a time. And from what he found, he wrote a history of the world without leaving home. Bill Bryson, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you know, this whole idea about learning more about your house to learn more about from where we came is just a great opportunity for a book. Tell us how chimneys and population growth have anything to do with each other.
Originally, throughout most of the Middle Ages, from the moment that Anglo-Saxons moved into Britain after the Romans withdrew, right up to the time of Chaucer, say, in the 14th century, houses were primarily one room. They were a type of house known as the hall house. And the house was the hall, and the hall was the house. And sometimes they were fairly grand, which is why the word hall is still denotes a grand place in a lot of contexts. Things like Carnegie Hall, or the Hall of Fame, or the Halls of Montezuma, and so on. Because once upon a time, that was really quite a grand space. But it was just one room in which everybody in the household, all the members, the family and servants and so on, all lived together and did everything together in one great space. There was one open fire in the middle of the room, and the smoke went up into the ceiling space and just kind of leaked out the roof. So the space up near the rafters was not usable in any way. It needed the invention of a real good chimney in a domestic setting to make it possible to kind of channel the smoke out of that upstairs space. And once that happened, then it very quickly occurred to people they could start to use that space, and the head of the household could build more private space up there. And it was from that point, around about the time of Geoffrey Chaucer, that the wealthier people, the house owner, began to kind of retire from his servants and move with his family into the more private parts of the house. And that's really when houses began to spread out and take on all kinds of new rooms.
Isn't that the reason why chimneys helped population grow, is people had more privacy?
The two are not disconnected, and there was greater privacy. I mean, you weren't doing these things in front of lots and lots of people, but it was still until quite recent times, it was not at all unusual to sleep in the same room, have a servant sleeping in your bedroom. So an awful lot of procreating was going on with at least one servant present. The whole idea of what constitutes absolute solemn privacy is really quite recent. I mean, it only dates from about 1800 onwards.
So sitting on the toilet was even a thing you might do not alone.
Today, if you go to Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, just outside the back door, there's a two-seater privy, which the father of our country may well have used himself in company with someone else. There wasn't the same concept of doing these things alone in solitude that we have now. It began when the houses branched out and started having upstairs, but it took a long time for that to become established.
So that's a fascinating thing that comes across in your book, is how fundamental concepts like privacy, and it was really interesting to hear your thoughts on the concept of comfortable. It was a big change in the 19th century, wasn't it?
Exactly. The word comfortable in the modern sense of being relaxed and kind of comfy only dates from 1770. And before that, comfort was something that you gave to people who were injured or distressed or wounded soldiers and so on. But comfort wasn't something that you thought of. It just didn't exist enough that people had the idea of comfort in the sense of furniture or clothing or the way we use it now. And it's a really interesting thing that comfort is something that you would think people would strive for instinctively right from the very beginning. And in a sense, we have, but most of the things that we have nowadays that make us comfortable have only existed in any kind of abundance since the end of the 19th century. So comfort is a really, really modern concept.
So your house was built in 1851 in a small town in England. In your work, putting this book, At Home, A Short History of Private Life, as you put that book together, did it occur to you 1851 is a great vintage for a house to be a rack upon which to hang all this information?
Well, yeah, I mean, I believed so, because for one thing, anybody alive in 1851, and the vicar, the rector who built our house in 1851, I mean, he lived until the early years of the 20th century. So anyone in that period, it was right on the cusp between the old kind of medieval world and the modern one. The rector who built our house and moved into it, you know, he was living in a world of horse-drawn carriages and candlelight and all of that kind of very old-fashioned stuff. But he lived into an age that had electricity and movies and the Wright brothers and skyscrapers and all the things that we associate with the modern age. So it was a period that was just on the cusp of going from the old way of the world to a new way. And never in history has domesticity changed so radically and so quickly.
Plus, you were born on the centennial of your own home.
I was indeed, just a kind of happy coincidence. And the other thing that was useful or relevant from the point of view of the book was that 1851 in England was the year of the Great Exhibition, which was the first World's Fair. And the Great Exhibition was the first time that there was a kind of World's Fair that was devoted to the idea of household implements and the kind of comforts of home, the things that we associate with sort of fine living. And that was, again, it was a pretty radical idea in the middle of the 19th century.
Well, you kick off your book with the chapter on the Crystal Palace, right?
Yeah, and the Crystal Palace was this wonderful thing. I mean, for the short time that it existed in London, it was the largest building in the world.
But, I mean, think about this, though. I mean, when I think of the Crystal Palace, they're just feeling their energy and their excitement about the dawn of the modern age. It was made out of, what, iron and glass, and they were able to build it on schedule, celebrate it, and then take it down like a big erector set?
Yes, and it was designed by a gardener. It was said, you know, Joseph Paxton, who was the gardener at Chatsworth House, a big stately home in Derbyshire. Nobody could come up with a design that would allow them to build a large enough exhibition hall in the time available and to the budget available. And he came up with the idea of, well, why don't we make it essentially just like a very, very big greenhouse? Because he was a gardener. He was used to building greenhouses. And so that's what they did. They built a greenhouse. But it was a greenhouse that was absolutely enormous. It was big enough to hold four St. Paul's cathedrals. So it was on a scale that was colossal.
It must have just blown people away. They must have traveled from far and wide and just their jaws dropped at the wonder of this big glass and iron building.
Yeah, well, nobody had ever seen anything like it. I mean, we're used to seeing glassy buildings now. I mean, you go to, you know, downtown of any big city and most of the buildings, what you see is mostly reflective glass. But in 1851, you know, buildings were not made with a lot of glass. So this would have been doubly dazzling, not just the scale of it, but the fact that it looked so light and ethereal. People often likened it to a soap bubble.
But the symbolism of that being a transition between, you know, the old world and the modern age, talk about lighting for a minute.
Yeah, well, something everybody should do. I mean, all people should do sometime. I did this myself when I was writing the book. It's a very interesting experiment. It's just draw all the curtains in a room late at night at home and light one candle and then try and live for just 15 minutes by the light of a single candle. Try and read a newspaper or a book or something. And you would be amazed. It is essentially impossible for us now in the 21st century to get by with one candle. It's just too dim a light. And it's a really, really annoying light because candles flicker. And so the light that it casts on your book or whatever is just completely hopelessly inadequate. And yet, you know, right up until the time of, you know, our great-grandparents, certainly, that was about the amount of illumination that most people had in their homes in the evening, unless it was a really big occasion or something. But most people got by with, if you were at home, you and your wife and children or whatever would sit around by the light of a single candle. That's all there was.
Bill, when we're talking about chimneys, I think of an inglenook. And when you travel, you go to these grand, stately English homes, and the fireplaces are big enough to actually sit inside of them. There's little stone benches on either side. Tell us about the inglenook.
Well, yes. I mean, the house I live in England now, the house that's at the heart of this book, is like many English houses, is not very warm in the wintertime. The central heating doesn't work very well. It's full of drafts and it's uncomfortable. And we get by on the fire from open fireplaces in the two rooms that we live in the most. And you have to get very, very close to the fires in order to get warm. And of course, it tends to make you very warm on the part that's facing the fire, but the back of you or whatever part is facing away from it is still quite chilly. So the whole idea of the inglenook was that it essentially allowed you to, as it were, get into the fireplace or to be in a much cozier environment. It really was a necessity because it could be really cold. The thing about fireplaces is that they're not very efficient ways of producing heat. They're really good ways of extracting smoke and getting kind of toxic smoke out of the room, but they're not very good way of producing heat into a room because most of the heat goes straight up the flue.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Bill Bryson, and Bill's latest book is At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Bill, it's a fascinating book, and your conclusion was quite surprising to me and also fascinating. Tell us how our quest for comfort could actually take us a different direction.
Well, We live in a very interesting time because we are able to enjoy all of the conveniences that, you know, burning copious amounts of electricity and using up lots of Earth's resources provide us. We're very, very lucky in that. You know, we are all very, very comfortable at home. But we also know that the Earth is facing perilous times with global warming. And so we're in this, those of us who are alive now are in a really lucky position that we can have all of the comforts and convenience that all of these, that living fairly extravagant lifestyles bring us. But at the same time, when you look out your windows, you still see a very green, happy Earth out there. We don't know how much longer that can continue for, how sustainable that is. So the point I was simply making at the end of the book is that we are in this position that we've worked very hard to make ourselves comfortable, but the very things that are making us comfortable could actually pose a long-term risk to the planet. What a terrible thing that would be if in the quest just to be ever more comfortable and to be able to wear kind of summery clothing in winter at our own home, that we ended up essentially ruining the planet.
I have this fascinating image I got from your book of you standing on that little platform on the rooftop of your 1851 home, surveying the estate of the vicar who built that thing so long ago. And it's so lush and green like England is today, 150 years later. Let's hope somebody can stand on your rooftop in 150 years from today and see the same lush and green environment.
Well, that was absolutely my conclusion of the book, is, you know, hope we can sustain all this.
Bill Bryson, At Home, A Short History of Private Life. Congratulations on your book and best wishes. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's been my pleasure.
Rick Steves teaches smart travel to England, Scotland, Ireland, and beyond. At ricksteves.com, you'll find an archive of interviews from his radio show, free audio tours, a monthly travel newsletter, and a world of information to help you turn your travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. To gear up for your next adventure in Great Britain or Ireland, begin your trip at ricksteves.com.